Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, the chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We welcome our listening audiences both online and on the radio, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. It's my pleasure to introduce our three speakers tonight, all from California Common Sense, an organization that grew at Stanford and is making very interesting inroads into the problems of our state government's dysfunctions, malfunctions. Dick and Sloss, who's the president of California Common Sense. Evan Storms, who's the research director. And within a few minutes, Joel Lonsdale, the chairman of the board, who will be arriving within the few minutes and before it's his turn to speak, we hope. So welcome very much, and please let us know what you're doing about something that we're all very, very concerned about.
Thank you so much for having us. Yeah, sorry about Joe being slightly late. The plane is delayed a little bit, but he should be here shortly. So I'll jump right in. Let's go to the next slide. So about 18 months ago, a group of Stanford students, including Matt Cook, who was a Stanford senior at the time, got together, and along with some alumni, including Joe, they were pretty upset with how California's government was not functioning, as I'm sure many of you are, and they wanted to use their Stanford technological abilities and Silicon Valley analytics to figure out tools that could help us understand the problem really concretely instead of kind of the vague dissatisfaction that a lot of people have, and then also do something about it. So a complete process based on web technology from which someone could look, see how California's government is or is not working, figure out which things they care about most, and then actually make something happen in the process so that it improved. So the basic mission is to open government finances to the public, engage you citizens in data-driven discourse, and I'll get to what that means. We'll talk a lot about that. And then ultimately create this grassroots movement, particularly of young people, that are working to fix California's government. So let's go ahead. So we began by creating an organizational chart of California state government. Does anyone want to guess, and maybe this will mess up the recording, so I apologize. Does anyone want to guess how many state entities there are in the executive branch? And if you already know the answer to this, then let someone else answer. Any guesses? 100? Let's go a little higher. 1,000? Let's go higher. Almost. So it's about 3,800. At which point, you know, I probably shouldn't have to finish the presentation because we understand part of what the problem is. It was quite a task to create this map. We spent all of last summer doing that. And many times we ran into what would be a repeated problem, a lack of information technology, actually, in California state government. Because no one had ever created this sort of comprehensive organizational chart. Many entities didn't have their own or knew what the organizations working under them were. And you really just ran into this bureaucracy that was so clearly not on top of its game, so to speak. It didn't know what was going on. And we really had to spend a tremendous amount of time and energy figuring out and piecing it together. But now this is online at cacs.org. On the homepage, you can see the map or under the research section. And what we realized as we were doing this was there's lots of entities that have very similar purposes or functions, sometimes directly overlapping. In other cases, we thought there was a lot of potential to consolidate them in ways where it would cost taxpayers less and we could deliver services more efficiently. So what we wanted to do was create a tool that will allow people to really dive into the finances of the state in detail, not just understanding the structural nature of the problems, but also the financial nature of them. So let's go ahead. Before I talk about the financial tool that we've created, just a few of the successes we had early. Our research started being used by some assembly members putting together legislation about how to improve California's financial situation. Also, the state of Georgia approached us and asked us to complete an analysis. Evan over here could tell you more in the question and answer session if you're curious. Basically comparing spending across counties and identifying where there were potential efficiencies and inefficiencies. And then also the U.S. House of Representatives asked us to submit a report on overlapping job training programs. And we found in that analysis that out of $15 billion being spent on job training programs at the federal level, approximately $8.1 billion of that could potentially be saved just by some pretty simple consolidations of programs that are serving basically the same target audiences and spending very disparate amounts on that. So let's go ahead. One other thing that's important to note before we get to the real meat of the presentation is the political nature of this organization. In many ways, it's not really a political organization. We're trying to change how politics is working, and we've brought together a really good bipartisan coalition for that. We have supporters such as former Mayor Willie Brown Jr., former Secretary of State George Shultz, former State Controller Steve Wesley, former Chairman of the Republican Party Duff Sundheim, and we keep bringing on more people because they're really excited about this. It really doesn't fit into the typical political mold, because the typical political mold is not about facts and data and policy. And we'll get to what some of the response has been from the political arena to facts being introduced. And it's both discouraging and hope-inspiring in certain ways. So we've got a really fantastic network of supporters, both from that political side and then also from the Silicon Valley technology side, helping us with this and advising us. And that's been a phenomenal experience for us to kind of learn from them and incorporate that into what we're doing as we really take on a big challenge. So let's go to the transparency portal, the next slide. I'm going to let Evan talk primarily about this, but just to introduce the idea briefly, as I said, we wanted to create a tool that would allow the average citizen to easily understand the state's finances. So we created what we're calling a transparency portal, which is the first step in our strategic plan to create what I was calling data-driven discourse. Sorry if all the terminology is kind of silly. But basically what it is it's a bunch of interactive visualizations where you can go see graphically, visually, how the state's spending your money. And with that, I'll let Evan take over for a bit. And it looks like Joe will be walking in a sec just on time. Welcome,
Hi, Joe.
So
before I actually show off the portal, I want to talk a little bit about the motivation for it. Fundamentally, as much as we think this portal is cool, as much as we want to show it off to other people, a really big part of this portal was so that of building this portal was so that we could understand the California government ourselves. Because we were very frustrated when we tried to find out, you know, how much is the state spending on this or on this or on this. When we tried to look for that information, we couldn't find it. Or if we found that information, it was buried somewhere on page 632 out of 5,000 in a financial document on the back of some website that we'd spent, you know, 4 days looking for. So we were very, very frustrated with how little information was out there and how hard it was to understand that information. And that's what led us to build the transparency portal. And it's kind of, it's this great synergy where what we needed to help us understand the government is now become something that we can use to show other people how the California government works. Okay. Which one should we go to first?
The history of California finances. So we're now opening up the transparency portal itself, and we'll tour you through that a little bit.
Okay, this is one of the first visualizations we built, and it's pretty simple information. This red line here is the state's expenditures. This blue line here is the state's revenues.
And it's important to note the discrepancy between those is largely due to the fact that federal funds are not counted as revenues.
And this orange line here is the number of people working for the state. So as you can see, our expenditures, revenues, and the number of employees in the state of California have all gone up over the past 30 years. But that information, which, by the way, was actually still a little bit hard to come by, is by far just the beginning of this visualization. So one thing that this visualization can do pretty easily, we can control for inflation or not, if you want to see the effects of that. And we can also adjust the metrics to be set per capita. So right now what you're looking at on these lines is how expenditures, revenue, and the number of employees have changed per capita for the state of California. And you see over the past 30 years, expenditures and revenues have gone up a little bit per person, whereas the number of employees has actually decreased a little bit and leveled off. The real power of this visualization, though, is its ability to do this. We can break it down. And now each of these lines shows you the spending or the number of employees in a different branch of the California government. So this is higher education, for example. This is corrections. And if we want to focus on just one,
we'll focus on corrections to begin with.
We can click there. And then right now what you're seeing is the increase over the past 30 years in expenditures and the number of employees per capita in the California Department of Corrections. I don't think I need to say a lot.
In case you cannot see, because it's a little bit difficult to see perhaps on the screen, Expenditures have gone up approximately fivefold per capita on the correctional system, and the number of employees for the state government in corrections has gone up approximately threefold. And in the meantime, we've been seeing cuts to higher education, obviously, and a lot of other things that I think arguably many Californians would prefer to see our money going to. Some other statistics that are relevant to this, and we'll go into now a nationwide visualization to give some context for this. But we're spending approximately $55,000 now at this point per prisoner, which is enough to pay for our Stanford education each year. And they're definitely, from what I can tell, not being treated quite as well as we are, despite that we're spending so much. So now we're going into the nationwide visualization, and I'll let Evan again explain us through that one.
So this visualization is on the pay of public employees. You see here a map of the 40 different states that have given us data. Some states haven't actually released this data, or we haven't been able to obtain it. But the size of the dot on each state here, for example, California, is the number of public employees. And then the color of the dot, how dark blue it is, and I don't know how easy it is to discern on that screen, but it's very easy on a computer, is how highly, on average, those employees are paid. So if we highlight California, we see that on average, the California public employee is making almost $65,000 a year, while on average, a public employee working for any state in the country is making just below $55,000 a year.
And it's really important to note that all of these figures are already pre-adjusted for cost of living.
Right. So that's not just the effect of it being higher, it being more expensive to live in the state of California.
But the real power here, actually, there's millions of data points in this that you can't see right now, and we're going to look at one of them, but I encourage all of you to afterwards go look at others, because you can make all sorts of very interesting comparisons. So let's zoom in on a particular department, Evan. We can actually break it down by approximately 60 different departments, and we'll go to corrections, because that's what we were just talking about. And then we'll also go look at correctional officers in particular, because we can zoom down to particular positions, which is why there's so many different data points if you look at the combinations of positions and departments. So are we – I can't see that screen.
We've updated.
We're there. Perfect. So scroll over California. So now what we're looking at is the average compensation for California correctional officers, which, if I'm not mistaken, is approximately $78,000. This is all adjusted for cost of living. And the national average is just over $50,000. So a discrepancy of approximately $28,000. And for 25,000, so to speak, or roughly speaking, correctional officers, that comes out to $625 million extra that we're paying each year for correctional officers, which begins to explain some of the numbers that we know about the amount we're spending on corrections. There's obviously lots of other factors in terms of the number of people that are being sent to prison is very high in California. And despite the fact that we're doing all of this, we still have one of the highest recidivism rates in California. So what we've done at this point is kind of showed you a very short story that you could trace out through a few of the different visualizations. There's a ton more, and people have been finding a lot of other ones. We found lots of other ones. There's a few other visualizations. Throughout the course of the summer, we've created other visualizations. What we're going to show you now is actually something that we're launching to the press in about an hour, so you're the first people to see it. Let's go to San Francisco's visualizations. So what we're now doing is creating similar visualizations for every city and county across the state and allowing people to see really the same sort of information for their local municipalities, which turns out in many ways to be even harder because the lack of transparency is even more evident at those levels. So I'll let Evan walk us through this one a little bit, and we'll look at debt, you'll see.
All right. So what we've created here is a single visualization that actually allows you to see basically anything you would want to know about the finances of San Francisco. Right now we just have various categories of expenditures, and we can see the general trend in expenditures from about the last 20 years. But if we want to see other parts of finances, if we wanted to look at revenues, we can update and then see the state and then see the city's revenues. Or we can go to debt and we can look at how San Francisco's debt has been changing over the last 20 years. And we see that it's actually increased pretty dramatically from around
it's basically doubled.
6 million. Yes, to 1.4 billion.
If you go to let's adjust for population growth just to be as fair as possible. And it's already adjusted for inflation. So when you adjust for population growth, it's basically doubled from something like $700 per person in debt that the city has to approximately $1,400, give or take a little bit. This is just, again, one of the data points that's in the visualization. As we continue to do this for cities and counties across the state, there's just going to be a plethora of information that ultimately we really need lots of Californians such as yourselves to be exploring, because a small research team can't explore all of it by themselves. Now we'll talk a little bit about the response we've had to the transparency portal if we go back to the PowerPoint, which has been quite positive in most cases, but in some other cases not so positive. Apparently some of the audience members know what we're talking about. So let's continue to the next slide. So when we launched it, we've had some really good media attention. We've showed up kind of all across the state with Associated Press, San Jose Mercury News, SACB, LA Times, and later in the summer we actually ended up with some good national coverage in D.C., also the Huffington Post. And then there were some people that were not too thrilled with us. We'll go to that slide now. So when we were trying to create this transparency portal, the largest challenge was getting very detailed expenditure data. And in order to do that, we had to submit a variety of public records requests. I won't bore you with the full details of kind of how that played out, but ultimately, we were told that the level of detail of information we were looking for would not be released. And the reason why, sorry, I can't see the screen, so I'm going to bend over and look at it. Evan, why don't you read the quote for everyone?
All right. This is from Aaron Peth, the Deputy of Legal Affairs for Governor Brown's office. "We are denying your request as currently framed because it is so onerous that the public interest served by not disclosing the records clearly outweighs the public interest served by the disclosure of the records."
Say it one more time. I don't know if everyone heard that.
"We are denying your request as currently framed because it is so onerous that the public interest served by not disclosing the records clearly outweighs the public interest served by the disclosure of the records."
So the state's checkbook. We wanted to know how the state was spending money, and so we asked for the equivalent of a checkbook for the state.
And that data has been released by 20 other states, so we're not asking for something that other states haven't done.
In fact, in other states that are more transparent, like Texas, that data is put up on a monthly basis in Excel files, CSV files, text files, data visualizations, and just instantly made available to the public almost in real time. And we ultimately envision, we think that every state government, every city government, every government should have their system set up such that it's going out there, and you can see as a transaction's made, this was the transaction. Obviously, there are certain private transactions, but that's not the norm. So needless to say, this is concerning, and we bring it to everyone's attention for two reasons. First, I think it really illustrates why an organization like California Common Sense needs to exist. Because where we stand right now, the state government is not transparent. We'll talk about issues we ran into in other branches of government as well. But you really need someone that's going to play this watchdog role of getting data from the California state government and putting it out there so that you can understand how your money's being spent. And even with someone working pretty hard on that, there's a lot of resistance. That's not the culture that government has set up to this point. And second, I would encourage all of you to visit our website. We have a petition up asking for transparency in the California state government. It's just at cacs.org/petition.php, and please go sign that showing your support for that data to be released in more detail. It turns out, as a side note, that one of the major reasons that this may not be able to be released is they're using a 30-year-old accounting system. One, it's not even a central accounting system. They only use it for approximately 15% of their expenditures, and that's what's being called a central accounting system. And two, it's in very old coding languages. It's very out of date. They've started building a new project at this point, but they've sunk, I think, over $100 million into that. Hasn't gotten much of anyone over the last 6 years. So not good signs for Sacramento, which is only 2 hours from Silicon Valley and should really be the leader in these sorts of information technology projects across the country. So let's go on. After that, that was definitely our main project for the summer. It was really a colossal undertaking, but we didn't stop there. We moved on to the legislative branch next, the judicial branch next. And for the judicial branch, we created a visualization comparing county spending on trial courts and submitted that to the Office of Courts Research. It was pretty timely because, as some of you may know, we're experiencing some budget cuts here, and $200 million of those were allocated to the judicial system, in particular to the trial courts. And we showed a first step in figuring out how could you most effectively allocate those cuts by showing which county courts were overspending relative to other courts, adjusted for a variety of relevant factors. And then perhaps even more publicly noticeable was what we did with the Assembly. So I guess now about a month ago, there was a feud between a few different Assembly members about who was spending what in the Assembly. Like not on the state level, but just within the assembly, which has approximately $147 million budget, which assembly members were responsible for spending what. And it turned out that assembly members themselves did not even have access to this data. They're controlling a $200+ billion budget, which we don't have a checkbook for, and they themselves can't actually see the details of the spending even though they're the ones that are supposed to make those decisions. The LA Times and SACB started suing for this data because they would not release it. All of this pressure was kind of building up, but nothing had really happened. And up until this point, it was really just a feud between two Democrat assembly members, a leadership member, Speaker Perez, and then not a leadership member, assembly member Portantino. And the GOP had kind of not been involved in the discussion up until this point. We took some data that was available and compared expenditures and payroll and found huge discrepancies between how much they were reporting on staff salaries in the expenditures data and how much they were reporting on staff salaries in the payroll data. And it caused quite a stir. Within about 12 hours, the GOP caucus issued a statement demanding that newer and more accurate data be released. 3 days later, that data was released, and I've actually had confirmation from quite a few assembly members that the information we put out was really pivotal in applying the pressure to make that happen. So we're already seeing kind of concrete results that transparency and putting information out there to taxpayers can have a real impact on the political process that's going on. So 3 days later, they released the new data that's supposed to be more accurate in the name of transparency. We looked through it, and we found still you could systematically see that for all the assembly members, other than Portantino, who was the one who was requesting this information and was kind of in a spat with leadership, all of their personal staff salaries had been downshifted to other categories like leadership, committee, overhead. So it looked like assembly members other than Portantino were spending far less, and he was spending the most, which in and of itself was suspicious given that he was kind of the center of the discussion. But when we did all the math, he was actually the 18th highest spender out of 80 if you don't count any of those other categories. And we also found out if you count those other categories, he was 37th highest. So there was some very suspicious accounting going on. And this caused a little bit of a scandal. And it was quite interesting to be in the Capitol a few times around this. We actually, and we'll talk about why, we wanted to talk to a lot of elected officials about a project that we have coming up. But they were all calling us because they were quite frankly a little bit scared. The whole system is set up in a way such that they're just not prepared to deal with the facts and the data being out there. There are definitely certain assembly members who want that out there, but there has been a huge resistance to that. And it's, again, further evidence why a movement like this needs to be going on, because there's just no way to get out of the sort of budget problems we're in without first understanding them. And then the last important fact is we testified to the Assembly Rules Committee based on the research that we submitted, and it was independently verified by the SACB and, as I said, got covered kind of nationally. So it made a real big story. Then I'm going to just sketch briefly what our future plans are. We've already accomplished quite a bit, we think, this summer. And then I'm going to let Joe talk a lot about some of those future plans. So the three big expansions is an interactivity add-on, an engagement platform, which Joe is going to say quite a bit about. Second, as I mentioned, we're going to be doing all of the cities and counties across California. And then third, we're going to be doing very detailed visualizations for particular areas of government, partnering with a lot of different nonprofits around the state and public policy institutes that are all pretty excited about taking their research and our research and putting it up in interactive visualizations. So, for example, with the corrections one, we're going to track in detail where every dollar is going within the corrections system and why perhaps we're not getting the sort of performance outcomes that we would expect. So with that, let me turn it over to Joe, and let's go to the next slide.
All right. Thanks, Dakin. I'm just a sponsor and of the organization, but I've been helping a little bit with leadership. We put it together a year and a half ago, and I'm really, really impressed by what Dakin and the other Stanford students have accomplished here. It's really humbling how much they could do. It's actually a little bit surprising. Because there's nobody else working on these issues at all, and so it's like you put some really bright people on it, and there's a lot that technology and transparency can accomplish. But one of the frustrations about this is you can make all these things transparent, and we found hundreds of examples of waste that when you ask your friends on both the left and the right, they all agree, yes, this is wasteful. The government shouldn't be doing this. It's clearly something being driven by special interests. But then if you stop there, you haven't really accomplished anything because now you've pointed all of this out, but it's still happening. And so the question is, what can we actually do to kind of go from, yes, there's hundreds of things that are common sense that we shouldn't be doing, to actually taking action and making this something where we can change the system? And there's no really easy answer for that, but it seems like what's possible now with technology is that we can have a lot more civic engagement, and we can start bringing more people into the process. And one of the things we've gotten when we've talked to politicians is that, like, these people aren't all bad people. Like, a lot of them go into government because they actually want to fix things. But what happens is you get there and you want to get elected again, and so you have all these special interests you have to work with. And so their main job becomes making the special interests happy and doing all these things that are wasteful, because it's the only way they can keep their job and they can kind of play the game. And so the question is, how can technology change that game? And one of our thoughts has been to get these politicians to kind of get together and work with us. What we've done is we're building a portal where we're going to put out studies, maybe just like 4 or 5 studies at first with other people's help. Here's obvious wasteful things that need to be fixed. And, you know, we've been involved, or I've been involved in Silicon Valley for a while. I'm an entrepreneur. And, you know, my friend started Facebook, and we've done a lot of these different companies down there. And so what we think we could do is we can kind of, you know, use social media advertising, get several thousand people on this. We already have tens of thousands of people engaged. They can kind of, and I guess Dakin can explain exactly how it works. But the idea is you can get people to take action, and the politicians agree. If people say this is a big issue, they're going to go and fix it. And if we think once we've actually fixed a few things where people come and take action and politicians fix it, that we can kind of get an ecosystem going where more and more people are coming to fix it, more and more politicians are getting involved, and there's ways we can use the media for that and everything else. And the basic idea is that we deserve the government we have, and right now there's like nothing that anyone in my generation tends to do to fix it, and we think this might be a way we can get people involved in actually fixing some of this. I'll let Dakin explain how it works, because I think it's a pretty clever thing.
Yeah, thank you, Joe. And Joe has been really great as a mentor and also as one of our major financial supporters. So basically what we have here is a new technology to help people not only understand the problem, but as I said at the beginning, take action based on it. So let's say you were using the transparency portal and you found that story comparing correctional officer pay across the country, and that was something that you thought shouldn't be that way. And it's also, you could flag something that you think is good if you want to share that with people. Unfortunately, we're not finding as many of those. So you could share that and then take a screenshot, put a comment saying what you think that screenshot means, post it to this interactive forum, and start creating an interactive dialogue with the rest of your fellow citizens there on this discussion forum. And we've actually gotten a really good broad-based coalition at this point of other nonprofits that are also going to be directing traffic to this. So this is not a single institution putting this forward. This is really something we're positioning as the place for dialogue about the future of California to happen. So someone can share a story there, and if you click on the story, you'll see a page something like this. I put this together. I'm not our designer, so it's not as pretty as what the actual page looks like. But basically, you'll see the picture that someone has shared, a comment, and then there'll be a place for you to comment also, have this dialogue. And then on the left-hand side, a giant take action button. So, and also a bar graph showing how many people have taken action. And there's some models out there already of people individually taking action and sending an email to their elected official, which we don't think is the most effective way to do this because it's kind of discouraging. You send an email, you don't see anything happen, there's nothing going on, even if I've engaged, it's not a successful engagement. So we wanted to create a new model of citizen engagement where people could get together, apply pressure in a certain sense, and I think it's pressure that will be welcome for most elected officials to balance the pressure of those special interests. So after enough people have taken action, various levels will be opened up. So at the first level, we'll take the story and we'll do a little custom analysis of it. With the correctional officer one, we might calculate what's the total amount we could potentially save here. $625 million is what I said before, roughly speaking. And then how many teachers could we hire instead? How many daycare centers could we build? What, if we were thinking about our priorities, could we do with this money that would be more effective for California? Then, at the next level, we've gotten a ton of elected officials signing on to this, both in the executive branch and in the legislative branch. And basically, we'll email all of them saying, this number of people have taken action, maybe it's 10,000, we haven't worked out the exact numbers, and they want to hear what you have to say about it. Do you agree that this is a problem? Do you agree this is a good thing? If it's a problem, what are you going to do about it? They'll be given a little bit of time to respond, and then all their names will show up with little smiley faces if they've responded and frown faces if they have not. And you can click the smiley face and see their featured page with their response and other responses that they may have had to other posts. And if you click the frown face at the end of the week, we'll send the total number of people that clicked their frown face to them, saying this many people, perhaps in particular constituents, want to hear what you have to say about this. What's gonna happen here? And we think that we can get a lot of people to use this, because what we've basically done is taken something that most of us would want to be able to do, which is influence the process, and made it really easy. You just have to press a button. I think of it as we've lowered the transaction cost for citizens to engage with the process. And we're pretty excited about that. We think we're going to get very large numbers of people doing this,
yeah,
particularly young people.
And I'd like to comment on why, I'll just tie it in a little bit with our name, California Common Sense, because this is in a sense, technologically revolutionary, because you don't have this type of interactive technology with the government. But right now, we have the technology that I can tell my aunt in Virginia that I like a picture of her cat with the click of a button, but I can't tell my assembly member that I don't like the way he voted on the last bill, or that I don't like some wasteful spending that I found, short of writing, you know, a letter and an email hoping that it reaches him. So really, you know, this technology is in place. It's revolutionary only in the sense that it's being applied to government, and it's common sense that it needs to be applied to government now.
Yeah, that's a really good point. There's a lot more that could be said. And then at the last level, basically if approximately 50,000 people have taken action, first we have the custom analysis, then elected officials engaging, and then ultimately the media. We're setting up a lot of good partnerships with media and have a lot of editorial boards involved with us, where they will publicize the story and really help it go viral once enough people have jumped on board. We're still about in the middle of engineering this. It should be done November, December. And when we launch it, we think it's really going to be a major tool in helping California get back on track. And it also is a bigger vision than that in many ways. It's a new model for how we think of representative democracy, and it allows us to get people back into the process and special interests out. Because right now our voices don't count for as much as the special interests. But this technology is really equalizing and democratizing much in the way that other technologies have been in the past. And we're very fortunate to have people like Joe that are experienced with this from Silicon Valley helping us, guiding us, and basically creating the art of viral marketing for a product like this. And we have some good celebrities that are going to help us promote this. And we really think we can get it out there to a lot of people and change the system slowly but surely.
Go ahead. Next slide.
Yeah. And then usually at the end of presentations, a lot of people ask us about funding, it turns out. So we're just telling everyone about our funding now up front. This is for next year. Over the past 18 months, we've spent approximately $120,000. We've been very frugal. Joe is the major backer through that, the only backer through that point. And now we've reached out and started fundraising more broadly across the Silicon Valley community. Next year, we're trying to raise for about six full-time people, an office and some basic promotional expenses, and we have like a base budget and a flex budget, and if you're interested in the details, I can go into it. But basically, the minimum we're trying to raise is about $470,000, and we've raised about $235,000 of that, so halfway there. And let's continue on. And then all our donors are listed here, and we currently have a $50,000 matching grant out there right now, so any money that's donated right now gets doubled. And I can go through the names if someone wants to, but they're all also up on our website. But we do think it's very important to be transparent about these things as well. And let's go ahead. If someone wants to donate, these are the instructions. And let's move ahead one more. What we really ask is that all of you get involved in this movement and tell your friends about it. We've been doing lots of events around the Bay Area speaking like this. Down in L.A. we did one last night. We want people engaging with us on Facebook, on Twitter, signing the petition. I'm really getting involved in what we see as the beginnings of a historic movement. There's lots more we could say. We've been working pretty hard. We could talk about other visualizations if people are interested. But at this point, I'd really like to let people ask questions, and if there's certain things you want to see from the portal, that's fine, either from the California one, the nationwide one, or the San Francisco one.
Well, thanks a lot for giving us that great introduction to what has got to be a fascinating project, and how much work went into that. Trying to make the government transparent is a little bit like Sisyphus's task. But it sounds like you're making inroads, at least getting up the hill, and that's just a fantastic thing to try. So we can now open it up for questions. Anybody would like to start? Hang on one second.
Thanks. Hi, Deacon. Dave Salaberry. I've been a redistricting activist for the last 6 months. When will I be able to put up on my website the Twitter, YouTube, and your site so that you can click on it and go to you? And are you going to be like the Facebook for, this kind of knowing what's happening in the government as far as the finances go?
So that should be ready in approximately December. I mean, you can already link to us at this point if you'd like. There's a lot of good information there. But the forum feature that we were describing will be ready in approximately December. And we already have pretty active Facebook and Twitters going. And yes, in a certain sense, we will be the Facebook for these issues. But it's also different in very important senses.
My name is Bill Applegate. Validation of data that goes into your system, how do you establish that, and what is the credibility factor?
I'll let Evan talk about this in a sec. He's our lead researcher, very bright guy, really lucky to have him. But basically, most of the data, all of the data, is coming from state entities, so there are obviously some questions about reliability as we think back about the information technology problems we've encountered. So we do some basic data cleaning that he can talk about. And ultimately, we have to rely on those state entities because we have so much data to be releasing something that's accurate, and we do basic checks, and he can say about that.
Right. So we have a relatively thorough process for making sure that all of the data we put up is consistent and makes sense. So we take spending data, and there's a pretty complicated series of checks, but basically we add up figures, we make sure the totals from one set of data match up to all of the other figures from other data sets that we're using. We eliminate anything that looks ridiculous. So, for example, in the employee payroll file that we received from the controller's office, we had people making negative millions of dollars a year. We also had other people making tens of billions of dollars a year. Now, those are clearly mistakes in the data that are very easy to remove.
Maybe. We were generous.
We're hoping that that's not the reason the state is bankrupt. But we can fix errors, we can fix inconsistencies, we can fix anything egregious. We do have to rely on the government for the general validity of the data, though. So if the California government tells us that it is paying an employee $57,000 a year, we're at this point, we believe that it's paying that employee $57,000 a year. But definitely down the road, as we develop more resources, we're going to start looking into not just what data is the government giving us, but also how can we verify that data.
And another important step in this process is we're setting up partnerships with a lot of different government entities so that we can really get access to kind of the underlying data sets themselves versus kind of the stuff they're putting out there. And we're making good inroads with that in Sacramento for some state entities.
Yeah, and one last important point is that it's actually not very easy for the government. The government can do a lot of shifting of different accounting figures, but if the numbers don't add up, we can generally find that and call them out on it, which is exactly what we did with the Assembly. So that was, that basically was the entire issue with the California Assembly spending, that the numbers didn't add up, and we found that.
Besides wishing you'd go away, what have you had any other reactions from the California legislators?
So it depends whether you're speaking to leadership or younger Assembly members. So the leadership is definitely displeased with us on both sides. And basically, the numbers looked worst for them, and that's why. I think in the long run, we'll move past that because we're doing things that can be really helpful to them. But the younger Assembly members, the way I like to think about it is all of them go there with the intention of helping us, and the longer you're there, the less you believe you can actually do that. So the younger members who still probably believe they can do that and aren't totally bought off by the special interests want tools like this that can help them understand the problem, help them reach out to their constituents, get them involved, and actually move past a lot of the mess here. So there are both discouraging and hopeful signs.
I guess it's good that we're not mentioning it, but one of the losers in the transparency battle actually had people on his payroll who did an ad hominem attack against me and a couple of other people who helped start this, which I thought was a big victory for us. Yeah,
we hit a nerve.
That's just the start, guys.
Thank you. I think it's a great project. You're at a pretty broad level, and I realize you have to be. But at some point, if you pick one of these things, like police that you're interested in or public safety, I think you have to get down into it. Instead of just showing that the per capita dollars are more, you have to try and go and find out why, either to justify or not justify. And that's the next step. And the other question is, do you guys come up with your own proposals to solve any problems, or you just leave it to the legislature to solve it for you.
Totally agree with the first point, and that's where we're going. And one of the things that's really important is to recognize that we're a platform for getting this information out there. And while we're definitely doing our own research, we try to do that with academics out there, with public policy institutes, because I think it's really crucial to have an internal knowledge of the workings of the state government before you try and propose specific solutions. So we can do a lot of the data analysis and number crunching that's really important in that steps, but that alone is not a solution. Finding the number, and it's really important to note that there has to be some understanding of the context for the number. What do the actual structures underlying that mean? So we will definitely be proposing some ideas that in conjunction with collaboration from government entities and public policy institutes that have better internal knowledge of the government can lead to solutions. One of the issues that we're looking at throughout the fall with the Stanford Institute for Economics and Policy Research and California Forward and the Irvine Foundation is pension reform, which is obviously a big one. And I think it exemplifies well what our approach for policy-oriented visualizations will be like. We're going to show what the unfunded liability is for every independent plan across the state, along with the big three at the state level. And people will be able to see what the projected unfunded liabilities are. And basically, that's like how much in debt we are and that we're not calling it debt. And what the various trade-offs are, because you're never really forced into a particular policy measure. It's really all about trade-offs, and that's what this is so good at showing. So there's three real options. You can try and change what the benefits packages are of employees, which has some serious legal complications, at least for past employees. For future employees, it's probably something that's going to be necessary just given the state of the pension funds. You can raise taxes, and we show what the impact of that is. We actually have done this for San Jose. You have to basically double property taxes in San Jose in order to make up the unfunded liabilities. A lot of the measures that are being on the table, like a quarter cent sales tax, doesn't really do much. I think it takes it from, what, $122 million in unfunded liabilities so 5 years out to $120 million?
I think it's down to $119 million.
Oh, okay. I was generous. And then also you can cut programs. And in San Jose, if you don't change benefits, you don't change tax structures, you have to cut every program other than public safety so that the San Jose state government would become a pension plan and a fire force and a police force and none of the other services that we count on would exist. And that presentation was well received. It was an audience of citizens in San Jose and half union members who this is ultimately a lot about. And they really understood the problem and understood that this should not be like a fight between like public employees and citizens. This is just promises were made that aren't keepable while performing the functions that we expect a government to do. And so our visualizations can be a really powerful tool for seeing what possible solutions would do. And then I think in many cases, when you see what those possible solutions would do, there is a natural conclusion afterwards, but we'll let other people draw those conclusions for themselves.
So for 2015, you're going to do Social Security and Medicare too?
Maybe.
Yes.
First of all, congratulations. This is an amazing project. It's so awesome that it's off the ground. I'm curious if you're taking any steps to safeguard your forthcoming engagement tool against being captured by special interests in the way that, you know, ballot initiative, signature gathering, other sort of supposedly democratizing forces like that also have been.
Yeah, there's certainly engineering problems of how do we keep it a place for facts and data-driven discourse. I should have said that during the presentation. That's what we mean by data-driven discourse, discussion based on the facts, the figures, the policy issues. And so there's engineering challenges about how do you prevent the political invective from showing up there. In terms of the actual content of stories posted, we're not letting people create new visualizations. We're letting people find stories within visualizations that we've created for ourselves and a network of partner organizations. So the content is definitely determined by kind of what we're putting together as a committee of organizations, much like if you've heard of the deliberative democracy poll that happened down in Torrance, where a variety of organizations, including the Commonwealth Club, I believe, were involved and put together a series of discussion points for citizens to begin off of and then try and reach a consensus based on. So it's not like the special interests can throw a bunch of new content in there. They can definitely post on the forum to the extent that they want, but the content is limited to, like, meaningful ideas in a certain sense. Does that make sense? I mean, maybe I didn't quite grasp the whole question.
No, it makes sense, but what about something like, you know, telling all of your employees that they have to hit your engage button and contact their legislators about a certain issue?
Yeah, I mean, it would be hard for them to do that in a way that's bad, because like, we're not going to put up content that says like destroy California and then let people like share stories about that. In general, the content is going to point towards here are relative inefficiencies, or here are things we could do better, here are things we're already doing well, let's applaud people for that. So just think about it as there's a set of fixed content, and the stories that someone can find in the fixed content, though it's possible to make suggestions that are probably unwise for the state of California, they'll generally be good things. And ultimately, if they're all hitting take action, you'd have to get quite a few public employees doing that in order to kind of outweigh the number of people fortunately still in.
I also think our bias is this kind of way of putting things out in the light tends to be anti-special interests. So if you think like we're spending $1.75 per page that we print right now at the assembly, and there's some legislators' friends who are running that printing press and making a bunch of money, that's going to be really hard to do with this kind of thing. Like it's just going to be obvious it's wrong, I think. And so there's a lot of things that happen that are just hidden away that when you do expose things like this, in general, it tends towards a good direction.
Right. They're not going to be able to. They're not going to be able to click a hide button or like don't yeah. take action button. So the facts will be there, and that's all they'll be able to respond to.
And I'm sure there will be problems that run up with that. We're still working on engineering it. But in general, I think the fact that the content is limited to what these good government nonprofits are putting out in public policy institutes means that it's very difficult, at minimum, for the special interests to be affecting that.
I think your concern is quite interesting and justified, too, because it seems to me what you're doing, as you said, you know, facts and politics don't often go together. And you're trying to put out a lot of facts. And that will appeal to, you know, once you have inroads and you become much better known, some of those facts are going to be very valuable to somebody, not for an objective use, but for their own political use, and they might want to capture you. That's I think, what you're concerned about as well.
Yes.
Well, you ask how are you going to prevent that from happening?
And it's our job to stay nonpartisan. That's something we have to do really well. Otherwise, we become discredited ourselves.
Yeah, and we're just not interested in political games. We're not going to, like, walk into that arena. We're trying to change that arena.
Actually, that leads me to my question. And has there been any other response from the governor's office? Has there been any movement towards more disclosure? What's happening with that?
Not much.
We haven't put as much pressure as we could yet. I think we want to get the Engage portal launched and really try to start doing more. And then we're going to go back to the governor and say, listen, like, this is obviously you should be releasing this. And then we're going to make a lot more noise about it soon. But I think right now we're just still getting our stuff in order.
Yeah. The goal is definitely nail the engineering, take it to the government, and get them really involved. Because I think that this is something that Governor Brown could really engage with.
Yeah, he should be on our side in theory. I think his office is
We just ran into the standard bureaucracy.
They said these are silly students. We don't have to deal with them, and that was their basic response. And so we'll see what they say later. Now.
Yeah. Next question.
What I'm hearing is that the stories that actually get on the website so that you can either click, you know, push it forward, I like it, or not, is going to be something that you guys come up with at CACS. In other words, it's not going to be an open, completely open process. I guess one of my problems is that good government nonprofits, I'm in the political world. My understanding, my belief is that everybody is political, including good government nonprofits. And so I'm just wondering how you ensure that there is a broad base of, you know, political ideas behind you, because the good government nonprofits tend to be, you know, more on the left, on the liberal side, is what I've experienced.
Yeah, no, I mean, and we're also working with organizations on the right or more on the libertarian leaning. It looks like a partnership may emerge with the Reason Foundation, so that there could be visualizations of their research in addition to organizations like California Forward, Think Long. And we're open to working with anyone that has constructive ideas that are not framed as political invective, but rather as data and fact. So if the Pacific Research Institute is interested, those sorts of things will be welcome. I think a natural starting point for us was good government groups. But we've definitely brought, as I said, you know, we've brought together a really diverse group of advisors, from Willie Brown to George Shultz. And it would be pretty hard, given the set of supporters we have, to like lean left or lean right, because they'd both be on us.
How did you collect all that data? I mean, obviously you had four or five people working for over the summer, you said, but still.
So
you delved into things that people have found twisted for a long time. I've done a lot of research projects as a lawyer on big deals, and it takes a long time just to find out because people are trying to hide the data. So
I can be kind of pushy. I took spring quarter off from school. We're all Stanford undergrads. Joe's out of school. Spent a lot of time calling state entities, discussing with them, sometimes perhaps arguing with them about getting this information released. And it was definitely a long and arduous process that in many ways is not over. But I think in general, the approach we're trying to take now that we've kind of established ourselves more is working with these entities because it's always easier to do that.
We've decided not to publicize yet a lot of the interaction with the state entities. It was actually quite embarrassing for how our government's run. A lot of places you'd call up people in charge and they wouldn't know how many people work for them and they wouldn't know how to find the data either. And so it was quite a few interesting interactions there that we'll probably keep them quiet for now, but maybe later on it'll be a source of amusement if we want to publicize some of that.
The standard response when you call a government bureaucrat and ask for something is, what? I don't know what you're talking about. Or, no, I can't give you my email. I don't have an email. And just ridiculous things.
That reminds me, I had a temporary job once at a telephone engineering company many, many years ago, before AT&T was broken up as the long-distance carrier. And I think most bureaucratic people who are working are in a similar mode. I went in, I was doing some advice and consulting for them. There were five or six people working in this department called telephone toll separations. And so I asked one of the women, what is toll separations? She said, I don't know. She said, you spend the entire day, you know, working on a calculator, making these divisions. You don't know how long have you been working here? She said, about 6 months. I said, well, who's been working here longer? So we went to the next one. 2 years, she didn't know. 3 years, she didn't know. 4 years, she didn't know. 5 years, she didn't know. So I had the whole department go to the boss. And the whole answer was, well, we have to separate the tolls, the long-distance tolls, between AT&T and the local carrier, and the local carrier gets a certain percent, and the other one by contract. And, you know, we do all the addition all day long. Now, it's just before computers took over. I'm sure they were all computerized within a couple of years after that. But
I wouldn't be so sure.
The lack of imagination and so on. I mean, I think that's just an extremely common experience. I've run into it many, many times. That was the extreme version of it. And I think that that's probably true. And even like you said, there may be good, you know, bureaucrats, good trying to help, but not enough imagination to find out how things operate. They know what they're supposed to do, and that's all they do.
It's a really important point that this is not like a government problem alone. This is like a large institution problem. Government happens to be the largest institution in our society nowadays, for better or worse. And anytime there's a large institution, there's bureaucracy, there's structures that are hard to deal with and that are usually inefficient. And so one of the things we really bring to this is kind of a Silicon Valley mindset of breaking it up into smaller units that are working better and getting past some of these bureaucratic issues. But, yeah, I think the sort of things that we're doing here could also equally be well done to major corporations.
Well, before you make it too efficient, the Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, was well known for being a place where bribery was how you got ahead. And I remember a study about 30 years ago by a professor who determined that if you added up all the bribes together, it amounted to about a 20% tax on everything that was going on, which is less than the tax we automatically give away to everybody else. And so that maybe a bribery system is actually more efficient from a tax point of view. Might not be culturally.
We're probably not going to accept that position.
That's great.
Is this the treasurer's job? Is there somebody in the government in the state of California whose job it is to actually basically do what you're doing, which is get all the numbers, understand them, analyze them, and, you know, have some presentation format for them? And who is that person, if they exist?
As usual, there's actually quite a few people. There's about five different entities that are supposed to be working with the state's finances in various capacities, the treasurer, the controller, the Department of Finance, a few others. And as it's set up right now, there is nobody who is assigned the responsibility of making this data transparent. In general, it would fall upon the controller's office. But yeah, I think a large part of our business plan is to put ourselves out of business within the next decade so that the government itself is doing this. It's not as clear how that would work with the forum. That may be something that just continues to be a nonprofit. There's plenty of ways to have a minor revenue stream that pays for itself. not as like a for-profit entity. But yeah, there's a lot of different entities that should be doing this, and one of the longer-term goals will be how do we institutionalize this, not in the bad way.
Yeah, I think something that's fun to do, or a little bit ironic, is if you go to transparency.ca.gov and look at the state's transparency website and try to learn something about the state government, just any fact at all about how the state government is operating, you will find it extremely, extremely frustrating.
Yeah, I was just going to comment again. I had worked for the something called the Bureau of the Budget these days, OMB, in Washington with President Johnson at a fairly high level. And I think the question over here is who's responsible or is there somebody I can go to? I think with respect to transparency, you guys are cutting a new edge of how to do things. But there clearly is, whether it's the governor's office itself or the assembly's office, somebody is responsible for putting the budget together and knowing enough to answer questions. And I would urge you guys, so you don't turn off the whole government system at this point, you're pretty critical. There are guys, I know in my experience, that you can call up, they have some responsibility, and they know something, and they're happy to chat with you.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe when you dig down into the how much you're spending per capita for your office, you're going to get a little resistance because it's an expose kind of thing. But when you say that there's kind of nobody, they're all bureaucrats, and nobody knows anything, and nobody knows how to answer a question, I think that may be true, but my experience, not only in the government, but out for a long time at Stanford Research Institute and other places, if you get the right guy, they're happy to talk to you about what their job is, and they may be able to answer some questions with good information. So I think we have to distinguish between good people and bad people. They're both in organizations, and getting information and coming up with policy answers. So I think you guys are more at the information stage now, and you're moving into what do we do about it.
Sorry. Sure, and if it wasn't clear from the presentation, we're totally cognizant of there are good people there. There's people in the legislative analyst's office, there's people in the controller's office, people in the treasurer's office that often want to answer these questions, and what we're finding is the way the government's set up is the data and information that's necessary to answer those questions is often not available. I met with the treasurer's office, and they want a certain set of data from the controller's office, but because it's split up, there's this sort of fragmented administration, they don't have access to that data that they would need to answer the question they want to answer, and it's just not well coordinated and synced. So that's one of the things that we're helping with, but we're definitely aware there are good people there that we are working with and want to be working with because, you know, they're in many ways the experts on these issues.
All right, well, we have time for one more question, and just for the information of everyone, there'll be a press conference afterwards if you want to wait and sit through the press conference. That you're welcome to as well. Is that all right?
We'll be showing off a bunch more information about San Francisco in particular, those set of visualizations that we're launching today. And then also, if you're taking off now or after, please drop a business card over by the sign-in sheet or sign in if you want to be on our mailing list and get information monthly about kind of what's progressing, what new features are available. And we'll also have a little time between now and the press conference if you want to ask further questions one-on-one.
Okay, one more question.
Just one quick addition. I think the one thing you guys do that's really important is the comparative. And you're not going to get that from even the best California treasurer ever. He's not going to go out and tout the fact that we're spending 20% more on XYZ versus another state, because that's competitively going to be a real problem for him.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons we started at the state level, because you really can see how to think about it relative to other things. There's a lot of good examples out there of what works, what doesn't work.
How did you get the state information? All the other states, those were the transparent states? Is that what you collected?
So we have payroll data for 40 states, and it was relatively uniform in terms of how easy it was to get, other than perhaps Mississippi, whose answer was, no, you can't have that data, and hung up. Like, it was actually really rude. And then, you know, there's actually a belt of about 10 states. If you look at the map that are physically contiguous, it's completely irrelevant but was interesting. And then for expenditures data, we got that for about half the country, the detailed expenditures, that checkbook level detail. And California was in many ways the worst to deal with on this. And it just took months and months, which is just so disappointing given what our technological status is as a state.
Well, Dakin, Joe, and Evan, thank you very much, first of all, for a great presentation on what you're up to, but also the fact you're even doing it and Joe supporting it. I mean, it's just a fantastic thing, and I think we're going to be hearing about you guys for years to come, and it's just wonderful to get in on the ground floor to hear what you're up to. So. And we also like to thank our audience here at the club, as well as those listening on the radio or online. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, held during its 108th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.